fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety, and those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. I'm your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is promoted by our partners, Dalmatian Productions, Inc., The Firehouse Tribune, FireTech, makers of on-scene soot and ash decon products, Hennessy Distributing, your source for the new cool towel, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The 5 Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now. The second annual Surviving the Fire Service Conference will be held on February 27, 2018 at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Billed as a behavioral health and cancer prevention conference, the event will feature speakers including Pat Morrison, the IAFF Assistant General President for Health, Safety, and Medicine, Dr. Denise Smith, Research Scientist at IFSI, and Captain Frank Lito, Deputy Director of the FDNY Counseling Unit, who will speak about health challenges in the fire service. There will also be a panel discussion on cancer in the fire service, as well as a presentation on tragedy and loss within the fire service from a chaplain's point of view. And a portion of the fees go to help the survivors of fallen firefighters. Additional information, including registration, can be found at http://nova.edu/conference/index.html, or send an email to us, dalmatprod@outlook.com, and we will be happy to send you the link. That's the 2017-2018 Surviving the Fire Service Conference on February 27th at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale. Make your reservations today. We want to take a moment to tell you about one of our great sponsors, the Firehouse Tribune. Firehouse Tribune is an emergency services web-based platform where individuals can learn, train, and share ideas and experiences. In life, both on and off duty, we live by one creed: excellence is a habit, not a goal. Interested? Find them on Twitter at FH Tribune, and visit their website at www.thefirehousetribune.com. Remember to always work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. Welcome to another edition of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. And today we're very pleased to have joining us Chief Daniel L. Jones. He is the former chief of the Chapel Hill Fire Department in North Carolina, not too far where I used to be in Guilford County in Greensboro. And today the chief is going to be talking about a really good subject that I don't know how many leaders will actually broach this. And the question is, what kind of a job does the fire service do to prepare leaders? So Chief Jones entered the fire service in February of 1974 and has served in a number of positions, including firefighter, paramedic, company officer, training officer, EMS chief, deputy chief, and as we just mentioned, retired as fire chief in 2015. Chief Jones served for over 16 years in the Pinellas Park, Florida Fire Department before relocating to Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1990 to become the fire chief there. While in Florida, he also served 5 years as commander of the multi-agency Pinellas County Hazardous Materials Team, responding to 23 jurisdictions in the Tampa Bay area. He also served as vice president and negotiating chair for Local 2193 of the IAFF in Pinellas Park. Upon his retirement, Chief Jones was currently the longest-serving municipal fire chief in the state of North Carolina. He has served on a variety of committees, councils, and boards at the local, state, and national levels. The chief is a former editor-in-chief of National Fire and Rescue Magazine, which for 10 years served a nationwide circulation community-sized fire departments. He is past president for the International Society of Fire Service Instructors. He serves on the National Advisory Council of Fire 2020, a group advocating for diversity in the fire service. He served on the president's FEMA/USFA Blue Ribbon Agency review panel in 1998 and served as first chairman for the NFPA Standards Committee number 610 on motorsports venue safety. And although not still chair, he still serves on NFPA 610. He is a past member of the National Board of Fire Service Professional Qualifications Committee and served on the NFPA Standards 1041 Instructor Qualifications Committee. Chief currently serves on the Board of Directors of Common Voices, a fire safety advocacy group, and the Board of Directors of South Orange Rescue Squad, a volunteer rescue and EMS agency in North Carolina. He was Florida Fire Instructor of the Year in 1981, and the American Fire Sprinkler Association named him Fire Service Person of the Year in 1997. In 2000, he was awarded the International Fire Chiefs Association President's Award. He was a co-recipient of the 2004 Goodman Award for Regional Leadership in the Triangle Region of North Carolina. He is a Knight member of the National Order of Life Safety Servants for successfully getting fire safety legislation passed. Jones had received commendations for the North Carolina JC UNC Burn Center, U.S. Congressman David Price, the NFPA, the IFSI, and the North Carolina State Fire Marshal. Chief Jones is also a recipient of the Order of the Longleaf Pine, the highest civilian honor awarded by the governor of North Carolina. Chief Jones has written numerous articles for trade journals and is a co-author of the fire service textbook Managing People, published in 1987. He is currently a special on-air commentator for CNN Headline News Network on breaking fire and rescue stories. He is a frequent emergency services conference speaker and is recognized throughout the fire service as an authority in the field of leadership, management, campus housing fire safety, and motorsports fire rescue. He is a guest lecturer at the University of North Carolina and has taught in 29 states, Canada, England, Germany, Botswana, and Scotland. Chief Jones has also served on numerous assessment and selection processes for fire officers and fire chiefs. The chief continues to consult and teach under his own company, Chief Dan Leadership, LLC, and in partnership with One Smart Center. Chief Jones attended St. Petersburg College, Alamance Community College, the National Fire Academy, the National Staff and Command Program, and the University of Maryland and the Institute of Government at the University of North Carolina. He completed the Public Executives Leadership Academy at UNC IOG in 2007. Chief Jones has held up to 12 emergency services technical certifications. He currently resides in Chapel Hill with his wife of 40 years in a home they built with fire sprinklers. They have a married daughter and a grandson. And Chief, it's been nice talking with you, but after that introduction, we're out of time. No, we're not. We want to welcome you.
You got to be tired. I'm tired just listening.
Well, that's okay. We welcome you. We're honored that you were able to find the time to join us. You have a great topic we're going to address today. And after reading your intro, there's no doubt about your qualifications to speak on this topic. And again, as we spoke, you know, last week when we were putting this together, you know, we both have this connection to North Carolina. I wasn't that far. I was about 45 minutes to an hour away when I was in Greensboro. I used to go to over to Duke Hospital for a couple of situations, and we did a transfer over to UNC, and just a great community. And matter of fact, my first injury happened in Rocky Mount. And so they took me to the Wake Emergency Hospital at that time. And so we have that connection. And I think when I have a connection with a guest that's not just simply I was a firefighter, you were a firefighter, it makes it a little bit more personal. So let's get started.
This is a beautiful part of the country to be from.
Oh, it is. And I still have great friends in up in Greensboro that we try to visit almost every year for at least the past 5 years. So we're going to talk about today. The first segment is going to be current status of leadership training and deficiencies we see. So why don't you take it away and start us off and let us know, does the fire service really, is it able to really prepare some of its members to be leaders?
Well, Steve, I am of the opinion, I've developed this opinion over the last 10 years, that we do a terrible, and I repeat, terrible job of preparing fire officers for senior leadership roles. I know that's probably stepping on a few toes, but when you talk to fire officers around the country in different departments and even fire chiefs, and you ask them, what's one of the greatest weaknesses in your department? And consistently, one of the top answers you get is training our officers.
Mm-hmm.
We do a great job of training people for the fireground. We do a great job of teaching tactics and strategy, of teaching size-up skills and different fire behavior sciences. We do a great job of teaching people incident command and how to apply resources in the field and response safety and firefighter safety. Our folks are very well trained in that all across the country. But if you ask chief officers, senior chief officers, assistant chiefs, deputy chiefs, and fire chiefs, if they felt prepared when they first got into those roles, consistently they will tell you they were not. And to me, that's a failure of our training. In the fire service, we tend to be drawn towards the sexy topics, the flames and smoke in the sky and the dramatic fun stuff that we all got into this business for. And the parts that are hazardous and dangerous, we train well on that. But when it comes to stepping up into senior leadership roles in our fire departments, it's not about that anymore. It's about organizational dynamics. It's about developing people. It's about politics, navigating the hazardous field of politics. It's about budgeting and strategic planning and community risk assessment. And all of these subjects, most people that get to that level have not had any of that training, or they've had very little of it. And our fire departments suffer because of it. We suffer at budget hearings. We suffer in public relations. We suffer in interaction with other agencies.
Mm-hmm.
We suffer politically. And so I really think we really need to shine a spotlight on the need to train people who are upwardly mobile and who are going to be our senior chief officers in the future.
You know, that's, excuse me, that's a very good point. And I think what you first said really brought back some memories to me. And I know it still goes on, but one of the departments that I joined to, a combination department, all the officers were elected by the membership.
Right.
And even though I went, when I went to this second department, I was already qualified as firefighter one and two, engineer and hydraulics, high-level rescue, and I was an EMT. In North Carolina at that time, I was certified as EMT-1, but house-trained by the EMS agency is to level 2 because before we went straight to paramedics then. And yet when I went to this agency, I didn't go out drinking with the guys on Friday night. So I never got, everybody knew my qualifications, but I never got even, you know, I think maybe once I was nominated, but I never got elected to it. Plus I had, behind all my fire stuff, I had my other training in leadership of nonprofit organizations, developing manpower, how do you get volunteers to stay in, and things like that. And I know that there are a lot of volunteer accommodation departments that still do that. But what really disturbs me is the fact that we're also talking about a lot of career departments, that we give our offices these other trainings, and they go through the testing, and they earn their levels, but we're not preparing them for the other side of the line. We have the fire line, where they're well trained for, and then we have the administrative line, which is saying that they're not trained for, and that we suffer from that, and that it has to. It's like an open wound, I think, for the fire service.
It is, when you are promoted or selected for a senior leadership role in a fire department, that's not the time to learn. You need a certain skill set already if you're going to be successful in that. And yet, in talking to officers across the country, for example, budgeting, frequently when somebody gets promoted to assistant chief or deputy chief, they learn budgeting because they're assigned to do the budget for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that you ask them, what did you have any training on budgeting or public funds or revenue or any of that kind of thing ahead of time? And they'll tell you no. They're handed a budget book from the previous year and said, oh, by the way, you're preparing our next budget. It seems completely backwards to what it should be. And, I look at the military, I draw a lot from the military of how they train people. And you can't progress to the next level of senior leadership in the military until you've completed certain schools that address what the responsibilities are going to be at that level.
Absolutely.
Think about how we select officers in the fire service. Not the least of which, as you just mentioned, is in combination or volunteer departments. It's elected frequently the most popular or the best fire ground officers are who are elected to the senior leadership positions. But think about in municipal and county career departments how that, we require certifications. Well, what are the certifications we require? They're almost all technical. They're, advanced heavy rescue, they're EMT or paramedic, they're inspector or instructor. It's technical certifications.
Right.
Some departments now require secondary education, some college, but very few specify what they're looking for. So if you've got a bachelor's degree or a master's degree in public administration, that's great. You've had some of this kind of training or business administration. But if you've got a degree in early Greek culture, a lot of fire departments still count that the same. What does that have to do with leading an organization?
Correct.
Nothing. There are some excellent programs in the fire service for aspiring senior officers. The Executive Fire Officer Program at the National Fire Academy is probably our best example. There's programs at places like the University of Maryland and Eastern Kentucky and University of Cincinnati have outstanding programs. There's some chiefs associations. The one that I think probably is one of the best in the country right now is the Virginia Fire Chiefs Association, puts on an excellent school every year for chief officers, for rising chief officers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a week-long academy, 6 days, that prepares middle-level officers for senior command. But how many tens of thousands of fire officers are there in the country, or how many chief officers are there in the country, versus how many actually get to attend a class like that every year?
Right.
EFO, how many people graduate from EFO every year? A couple of hundred at the most. Out of tens of thousands of fire officers, we're just not meeting the need. We're just not. And frequently we pick the best at the operations level, our best officers at the operations level, our best captains or battalion chiefs or whatever you call that in your particular department, and we put them into an administrative role, and it's Greek to them. It's totally different. That transition from the field to the office is a huge gap that we're just not addressing. We've been, the last couple of years, my teaching partner, Kelly Walsh of One Smart Career, she and I have been teaching leadership to rising chief officers around the country, and we'd like to ask them, how many of them have had training in marketing? We've had a number of chiefs tell us one of the things that surprised them the most when they became a deputy chief or fire chief was how much marketing was involved. Marketing their department to the citizens.
Right.
Marketing their services. Marketing the value of their agency to government decision makers. And we ask our students, how many have had any exposure to marketing classes at all? We rarely get anybody. Maybe somebody, one or two in a class, will have had a marketing course in college. Strategic planning, almost nobody has had training. Budgeting and capital programs, almost nobody's had training in that. How to navigate politics, how to deal with elected officials, how to keep your agency in a neutral position in a political atmosphere so that you're not being used by one side or the other.
Right.
Almost no training. Media relations. There's another really critical aspect of what we do. How many chief officers have had any formal training in how to deal with news media, how to conduct an on-air interview, how to do a segment for a live television shot, how to control the interview, how to pick your environment, your background for an interview. No training. And these are all things that are, in Dan's humble opinion, are hurting the fire service.
Do you think that there's, I'm trying to, how to phrase this. I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but do you think that there's this divide that most of the men and women who look to look towards promotion to upper level chief's position are really looking at it from the operations side only, and that they kind of feel that everything else is supposed to be, it's like the Wizard of Oz, it's all taken care of by the man behind the curtain. Do you think that that's part of the legacy that we're dealing with?
I think you're probably right to a degree. I think, during my 25 years as a fire chief, one of the things I always found interesting was when we had someone on light duty, we would bring them in from operations. And I'm talking firefighters, lieutenants, driver operators. We would bring them in to administration and assign them to one of the administrative chiefs to act as an assistant or to work on a project or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently those firefighters would say, I had no idea how much was going on in the administration of the department. They're surprised. They're shocked by the amount of workload in the types of work and the things that are going on in the administration of their department. We sort of isolate the troops from all of that, and I don't think they always have a good understanding. I mean, I went up through the ranks in my career. I served in a variety of roles, pretty much everything except the fire marshal position before I got to be a fire chief. And I was pretty confident that I had the skill sets necessary. But when I became a fire chief, it became real obvious to me real quickly that I was not well prepared for that role. And it became an on-the-job training process. And in the meantime, you're trying to lead an organization while you're learning how to lead an organization. a little bit like combining practice and concert at one time, you know.
Right, right.
Expecting an orchestra to not practice and just get in front of an audience and begin to play. And we see this in assessment processes, selection processes. I've served on a variety of selection processes for senior positions, fire chiefs, deputy chiefs, even police chiefs over the last 10 to 15 years. And I started keeping a list of things that I saw as weaknesses in candidates. And I'm not talking about necessarily small departments. I'm talking about metropolitan-sized departments in some cases. And candidates present themselves, and on paper they look really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got college education, they've got years of experience, they've got a progressive a career up through the ranks, and yet you start to see these frequently or common weaknesses or discrepancies in the candidate groups. Things like they can't answer questions about their own leadership values or management philosophies. They don't understand that. They can't write a logical, well-structured position paper with supporting documentation and information. They can't describe community factors they would consider when making recommendations for public safety improvements. They don't understand the role of the fire chief as part of an overall community management team that's involved in a variety of community issues, not just fire protection or EMS coverage. And when I sit down with HR directors or city managers, county managers, to review their candidate pools, and I have to explain to them that, well, you don't have a candidate that truly understands the role of a fire chief as part of the overall management team. To me, that's embarrassing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, like you, I love the fire service. I want the fire service to be as best as it can be. And when you have to say to a city manager looking for a good fire chief candidate, none of your candidates understand the complete role of fire chief, that's discouraging to me.
Well, certainly.
And it's part of why I've committed in my retirement years to work hard on this issue and try to help provide some of that training so that upcoming chief officers in the future aren't making the same kind of mistakes or having the same deficiencies that I had.
Right. Right. Well, you know, it sounds like the old case of wearing blinders, that we only see what's directly ahead of us and we don't use our peripheral vision to get a greater view of the situation. And for example, we compartmentalize. For example, fire prevention should just be that one guy or gal who's selected to be the fire prevention officer, and they're going to handle all the public relations stuff. And they only do it in October anyway, because October is really everybody knows that's Fire Prevention Week. Or the PIO.
Yeah.
Sometimes, for example, like you mentioned, when you take somebody who has a medical deferment for a while because of an injury or something like that, you bring him inside, and suddenly he or she is thrust into the position of PIO. And as you said, they have no idea other than trying to explain to the public or the press what that incident is and what's going on, but they've never done it before. They have no background in it, but they were put in that position because we had to do something with them. They were hurt, and we want them to be in there and they get paid. But so we're going to try to put that square peg in that round hole. And I think we need to take those blinders off at several levels that you've mentioned. You need to do it the acting chief has to be able to take those his or her blinders off. To see a more panoramic view of the department and the people that he or she is looking to bring up. And the community, the municipality or the county, wherever, has to understand that they need to bring in the people with the necessary overall skills, not just because you have a tank farm in there and they can do hazmat and liquid flammables very well. We want them to be able to do, as you said, budgeting, general administrative work. And you mentioned something else that was very important, and this is for both career and combination volunteer departments. We must have a strong connection with our governmental bodies, whether it's city council or on the state level and even the federal level. Yes, we have our
absolutely city,
because we need to
absolutely
know what is going on, and they need to be able to hear. They need to know what's going on from our side as well. And if we don't strive to increase and improve those connections with our governmental bodies, like I've on Twitter several times, I've recommended when the talk community or several firefighters have talked about having problems with the commissioners or something like that. I said, then what you need is invite them to Firefighting 101. And I've seen it. We've seen it on Twitter several times where they've done that. They bring them in, they dress them up in PPE, they put them maybe through a smokehouse or a dark mask. And then in two or three hours, these people, whoa, this is what you do? I just thought you put the wet stuff on the red stuff. And even
yes,
that little experience opens up their eyes to the real job that we do. And from there, once you have your foot in the door that way, then you can start working towards a stronger relationship with them so that they know the financials, the administrative situations that the department is concerned with and dealing with. And so they see the role that they need to play to help us as well. So it's a matter of education.
You make a good point, Steve. And I think back to one of the things we always share with our students is that the Pew Institute, which is an independent nonpartisan group that does research on trends in the American public and American society, have over the years several times done a survey of which institutions the American public most trusts. And consistently, the fire service is number two on that list, number two only behind the family unit, as the most trusted institution in the United States. It ranks above law enforcement. It ranks above the military. It ranks above government. It ranks above even the church, which I find really interesting. And politicians know this. That's why politicians love to take campaign pictures standing in front of fire trucks,
right,
or standing with firefighters behind them, because there's that element of public trust in the fire service. So they know how to use us. We don't know how to use them.
Exactly.
We don't know how to parlay that public trust into additional support when it comes to things like legislation that would help our jobs be safer, or budget expenditures that, when a fire department is denied a budget expenditure for thermal imagers, and yet budgeting money goes to parks and recreation for additional greenway space.
Right.
There's a priority where we've missed an opportunity. And we've missed that opportunity because our leadership does not know how to play that game and work the trust that we have into leverage with political figures.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example. Most fire chiefs will tell you they didn't have any dealings with politics unless maybe they were a union officer. Until they got to the senior command level.
Mm-hmm.
And you also, as you know, you watch social media, Twitter, Facebook, some of the fire service feeds, frequently mishandling political situations is a downfall for some fire service leaders.
Oh, absolutely.
Cost them their careers because they don't understand how to read and navigate political waters in their community.
Right. I think
so.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's just one area where that deficiency ends up hurting the fire service and hurting an individual fire department. if we gave our leaders on the way up some training in that area, maybe we could avoid some of those missteps and lost opportunities.
Certainly. You know, when you mentioned about the result of that Pew Institute, it reminds me of something that a wonderful fire leader that we recently lost, Chief Bruno, wrote in one of his articles in Fire Engineering Magazine, that he was at the airport and he was sitting next to this relatively elderly woman, and they started chatting, and she said, "Oh, what do you do?" And he says, "Well, I was a firefighter and fire chief for many years." And she turns, she goes, "You know, I've always found that firefighters are the nicest people in my community."
Yes.
And, you know, that's the way they see us. But we have to, even though that's nice to hear, compliments are always nice to hear, but we have to make sure that they know all about us, not just us taking care of Mrs. Smith's cat.
Yeah, you know, most communities don't even realize the wide range of services their fire departments provide to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, citizens frequently know very little about us. What they want to know is that we're competent, we're close by, and we'll come when they call.
Exactly.
They don't want to call us because, as Chief Bruno used to say, we're in the worst day of your life business. We respond when people are in a situation where they feel helpless or panicked and they don't know what else to do. That's when we come and make it better. But they don't truly understand the wide variety of things that we do. And as you well know, and most of your listeners know, over the last 25 to 30 years, we have moved from a single service of fire suppression to an all hazard service, where, you know, with the exception of security and law enforcement, we're pretty much the rest of the ball game.
Right.
When it comes to emergencies or hazards or risks or threats. And very few communities know that about their fire departments. And again, we're identifying a weakness in our leadership, that we're not marketing and educating our public enough to know exactly what our value is. What all do we offer in a community?
Right. Very true. All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a break here. When we come back with Chief Jones, we're going to talk about what should we be preparing our future leaders with and for. What skills do we need to provide to them or encourage them to develop? So we'll be right back with our guest, Chief Dan Jones, right after these words. No matter where we live, or no matter the season, there is always work to be done that makes us sweat. Just how can we keep cool? Well, Hennessy Distributing has the answer. Cool towels. Cool towels are 100% cotton towel and pre-moistened with all natural ingredients. The best part? No water is needed. Just open your cool towel pack, remove the towel, and give it a couple of shakes, and you're all set. Wrap it around your neck like a kerchief, wipe your face, arms, neck, or any exposed skin, and it is approximately 20 to 30 degrees below the ambient temperature. Wait, did it warm up? No problem. Just shake it a couple of times again, and Cool Towel delivers its refreshing cool touch all over again. When the cooling mixture has expired, use your cool towel as you would any cloth or rag around the house. Because it is manufactured from 100% cotton, your cool towel is 100% recyclable. For more information or to get your cool towel today, visit www.cooltowel.com or call 1-800-918-8323. Remember, you're going to work and you're going to sweat. Make Cool Towel your answer to keeping cool. When you're done knocking down the flames, you want to hit the apparatus and head back to the barn, right? Wrong. If you do, you're carrying all types of poisons and carcinogens with you and spreading them wherever you go. But you can clean your gear and yourself before you even leave the scene with a Fireground Decon Kit from the folks at FireTech. This kit contains everything you need to properly and safely decontaminate yourself while still on the scene. This kit includes a pop-up pod for a private changing room, exclusive Fireground Decon hose designed to reduce contamination, all-natural decon towels, a special PPE cleaner formulated to remove stubborn hydrocarbons and that meets NFPA 1851 standard, and more. With a cancer rate among firefighters at 60% against only 20% among the general population, we can no longer ignore the dangers we can't see. For more information, visit their website at www.firegrounddeconstore.com or call FireTech at 954-906-1118. Welcome back to this episode of Five Alarm Task Force. News and issues for today's first responders. And our guest today is Chief Daniel Jones, former fire chief of the Chapel Hill Fire Department in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the beautiful state of North Carolina. And the chief the chief has been talking about the vacuum that we have that the fire service has in preparing leaders. And we're talking not about just being an officer, but we're talking about everything it takes to be, especially a senior officer, that's not just on the fireground side, that you have to be a well-rounded individual and have a well-rounded knowledge to do the tasks that it takes. And yet, systemically, we have a problem with that we're not truly doing it or doing it well enough. So in this segment, we're going to address what should we be preparing our leaders for. That, because we do groom leaders, there's nothing wrong with that. We find people that seem to have that makeup, that people kind of gravitate to them and listen to them. They're not necessarily the boisterous ones or the ones who are bullies or yellers, but people just seem to listen to these people and they gravitate to them, and so we go out and groom them, and that's great. That's a good thing to do. But we must give them enough information that will allow them to do their job properly. So, Chief, why don't you take us now on this step? How do we prepare them?
Well, I think we need to put some more emphasis on training programs that are specifically designed to move officers from line positions. The right front seat of an engine or a ladder truck or a rescue, or the left front seat of a battalion wagon. We need to offer more training that prepares people for those administrative positions, those desk positions.
Mm-hmm.
We don't put a lot of emphasis on that in the fire service. Most of us didn't get into the fire service in order to fly a desk.
Right.
Most of us got into it for the pure essence of helping people and mitigating emergencies and the adrenaline rush of an emergency situation or a working structure fire.
Sure.
But as our careers evolve and develop, our organizations have to have leaders that lead the whole organization, not just on the fire ground. And we just don't address that much. A good example is if you go to the major conferences, you go to Firehouse Expo or FDIC or the FRI, the IFC's annual conference. You go to the major conferences, you walk the hall during workshops. Look at the workshops that are wall-to-wall people and out the door. Those are the workshops that are dealing with smoke and flames and emergency response. Go to the workshops, stick your head in the door of the workshops that are dealing with budgeting or politics or dealing with human relations issues or dealing with sexual harassment issues. And you're lucky if there's a third to a half of the room is full.
Mm-hmm.
So overall in the fire service, we need to put more emphasis on this leadership training. We need to be saying to our younger officers who aspire to move up, here are the programs that you need to be in. Here's what you need to be studying. You've had enough incident command training. You've had enough strategy and tactics training. It's time to shift gears now and start learning things like budgeting and human relations issues and negotiation issues. All of those things that we just don't pay attention to. We don't spend enough time on. And Steve, one of the things that I've done over the last few years is I got more and more focused on this issue. When we do selection processes, when I work with a couple of different private firms and cities that doing selection for fire chiefs or deputy chiefs.
Right.
I started, one of the things you do when you're doing that is you sit down with the leadership of the city or the fire chief, the city manager, county manager, whoever, HR director, and you say, okay, what are you looking for in a fire chief? Or what are you looking for in a deputy chief? And I started keeping a list of the things that they tell us, and I want to share that list with you.
Okay.
These are the things that they're looking for in senior leadership. The one that comes up most frequently is ability to communicate clearly, succinctly, and logically in both verbal and written forms. So communication skills. Second one is understanding the range of issues and problems facing local government. You'll notice it doesn't say issues and problems facing the fire service.
Right.
It's issues and problems facing local government because they want a member of a management team. They're not looking for the top firefighter. They're looking for a part of a community management team.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, ability to lead, inspire, and empower personnel. Well, there's your personnel development issue. Can you develop the talent below you? Can you bring people along and train people to move up? Another one, willingness to innovate, seek positive change, and plan for the future. You know, we live from fire call to fire call in the fire service.
Right.
We don't always look ahead much. It's kind of in our DNA that we're in a business where we deal with the immediate. We deal with what's in front of us. Like you were saying in the previous segment, we've got these blinders on. We don't look at the bigger picture a lot of times. And that's what they're looking for. A few more. Ability to mentor and prepare new leaders. Ability and willingness to be an active participant in overall city or county management team. Ability and willingness to be engaged in the community. High ethical and moral personal standards. And we're seeing that in our society today.
Oh, boy, are we.
What happens when leaders don't have that. Ability to adapt to changing environmental, financial, and political situations. You know, fire chiefs have a bad reputation among city managers of always wanting more and more and more and more and more without understanding that there are limited revenues and it has to cover a variety of services in the community. And so there's almost a bad reputation that fire chiefs have of always demanding more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's not important or not necessary, but you have to understand balance. Consistency, loyalty, enthusiasm, and accountability, they always list. And here's the one that I hear the least or always comes in last. A sound knowledge and experience base in all things fire and emergency services.
And that comes in last.
That's not the top of the list. It's not the top of their list. It's near the bottom of their list. It's a given that they want somebody who has good knowledge of fire and emergency services, but you see the things they rank above it.
Right.
And that's what we're not training our people for, is those things that are ranked above it.
So, the question, the elephant in the room is, how do we get the message across to both the departments and the communities that this is something that needs to be done? Now, I will say that what's really nice over the last few years in some of the journals, fire journals, we see a lot of schools, online schools, and at present schools advertising for these different degrees, not just fire science degrees. And so I think one thing is that the departments need to underscore to their people that we're not asking you that you have to go back to college for 4 years, but there are avenues. As you said, we have the National Fire Academy and in Eastern Kentucky, Cincinnati, where I lived, another great city, and a great
fire. University of Maryland.
Right, University of Maryland. And they have these other schools that are advertising with online courses. So, yeah, you do. Even my oldest daughter now is enrolled in a online master's program. She does 6 semesters online, and then 3 summers she has to travel. So she's been to Belize for 2 weeks for her first year. Last year, this past summer, she was in Borneo. And this summer, we're waiting to hear if she's going to Kenya or Namibia. And then she'll have one more semester, and she graduates a year from now. But it's been online, and she still works a very busy full-time job. So we need to let our personnel know that they can learn more besides the fire service, but they can learn about public administration and these sorts of things, not by having to pick up and move their family and go to another community, but actually by using their computer when they're home.
You're absolutely right. And the other thing that we need, the message that we need to get out to the fire service, is it doesn't always have to be fire classes.
Right.
You can go take a budgeting and accounting class in any community college.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fire budgeting. It's just budgeting or local government finance. Almost any community college offers courses like that. So my advice to a captain or a battalion chief who aspires to move up to higher command levels, fill in your education gaps yourself. Go seek this out, because there's no single source right now. The things that we lack in the fire service is there's not a single source for this kind of training.
Right.
Like I said, there's good programs out there. You listed several of them. Columbia Southern has a great online program for rising officers. But not everybody can do that. And not everybody has the means or the access to that. But you can go to your community college. You can take an organizational development class. You can take a mass media class, which will help you with media relations. You can take a class on ethics, business ethics.
There really are ethics. There are ethics in business.
Planning. Pardon?
Excuse me. I said there really are ethics in business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, another real good source of programs is a lot of colleges and universities have a school of government or a school of institute of government. It's where a lot of people go to get their master's in public administration. But almost all of those schools also offer certificate courses, academies, or leadership programs that they're not a degree program, but they're a program that teaches you how to lead and manage in the public sector,
mm-hmm.
which is what the fire service is.
Absolutely.
We get pretty brand loyal in the fire service. And if it doesn't say fire and emergency services in the title, we ignore it.
Yes, we do.
And yet that's exactly what we need to do. We need to reach outside. One of the things I tell fire officers a lot is, network.
Mm-hmm.
Go meet your counterparts in public works, or parks and rec, or the finance department. Go meet somebody in that department and have lunch with them and talk to them about what they do. Recently, one of my students said, "You know, the one thing that I missed the most in all of the training I've had," and I said, "What's that?" He said, it's understanding what other services my county offers and how those work. Because now he's a deputy chief and he's expected to interact with these other agencies and other division heads, and he doesn't know anything about what they do. And likewise, they probably don't know much about what we do.
Very true.
So reach over and make those contacts. Go to lunch with a counterpart from Public Works and find out how they function. What are their services? What are their concerns? And what you'll find is you have a lot of commonality with these people. And it will help you understand the role of the fire service in the total structure of local community services.
All right, so these are some great points for individuals that we're trying to say, but I think we still have to not just put a Band-Aid on, but we have to really close the wound in looking at it from the whole departmental, the concept of the fire service.
And there are fire chiefs now who recognize this issue, I think the IFC is beginning to recognize this issue and trying to address it for their members. Fire departments are creating officer development programs. They're bringing in instructors like myself and my partner Kelly to teach some of these skills to their rising officers. But we need a lot more of this to be going on. Again, I'll highlight the Virginia State Fire Chiefs Association. They, a number of years ago, created a company officer academy. They run it twice a year. And fire departments all over the state can send their rising company officers to a week-long academy that is taught by other officers and specialists that actually teach company officers some of the skills they'll need for leadership at that level. Not just the strategy and tactics, but things like human resource issues and personnel development issues and how to evaluate personnel and how to build working relationships with your supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a great job with that. And a couple of years ago, they created a Chief Officers Academy. Now that the focus is on the skills that we've been talking about. They've created a great model, and their Chiefs Association is doing this, not the state, the Fire Chiefs Association. They raised the funds for this, and they put this on. They put it on at the University of Richmond during the summertime. It's a 6-day-long course, and it focuses entirely on those soft leadership administrative skills, communication skills, news media skills, leadership and management, human relations, political relations. And all of the students that have gone through that tell us that this is tremendous, that it's caused them to rethink their whole career, and it's caused them to step back and realize the greater role or the wider range role that a chief officer has to play. The other thing that we need to convince the fire service of is some of the skills that we're very good at translate into the office. Incident management skills, incident command skills. When you talk to executives in the corporate world, they would kill to have the skill set that our office fire officers have.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to almost instantaneously assess a problem, develop a strategy and a plan to address it, assign resources, distribute and delegate authority to carry out the plan, set up an ad hoc communication system through using our incident command methodologies and the NEMS process to manage the whole process,
mm-hmm.
and do this instantaneously, and everybody understands their roles and how to make that function. You talk to people in the corporate world, and they're like, how do you do that? How is that done? because they take weeks and months to create a team to deal with a project. We can create a team to deal with a crisis situation in a matter of seconds or minutes. Those same skills, whether they're size up skills, division skills, where we break down a fire scene or emergency scene into divisions and sectors and parse that out and make different people responsible for it, and they coordinate amongst each other and back through operations and command. Those skills translate administratively. You can use those same skills to manage projects in the office, that same skill set.
Right.
And we don't step back and realize how valuable that skill set is and how to translate that into routine day-to-day functions.
Yeah, that I think, and that could apply really across the board in the community where you live, because, as you said, with your suggestion of going out and find a counterpart in another city department or county department and see how they deal with that stuff, they can learn as much from you as you can learn from them.
Because, oh, for sure.
You know, and when you have that symbiosis between the departments, or as you mentioned now, with in the corporate world, you get that symbiotic relationship. Both sides start to grow and thrive better, way better than had they still remained separate and independent of each other, because with a wall made up of egos in the way. And once you remove that wall, whether it's a city organization, a municipal organization, whatever, you create that symbiosis, which benefits not only the two departments, but it benefits the citizens.
Oh, absolutely. And ultimately, that's who we want to benefit. We're in a service delivery business. We don't sell candy bars or wing nuts or put chrome on bumpers. We sell a service. And beyond that, we have a monopoly.
Right.
We don't compete for the sale of that service. So our primary function has to be as efficient and as effective as we can be. And we have to make sure that to quote Chief Bruno, Mrs. Smith out there, understands what all we can do for her and how to access those services.
Exactly. Exactly. The more our citizens know about who we are and what we do, the more support and understanding we'll have from them. Doesn't mean they're going to agree on everything, but they'll at least understand it and be able to think it through properly, as opposed to shooting from the hip with the decision based on limited amount of information.
That's true. And to take that a step further, our company officers are our primary public relations contact. If you think about most cities, the majority of citizens are never going to meet or talk to the fire chief or the deputy chief. The contact we have in the field is going to be through sergeants, lieutenants, and captains. And maybe a battalion chief. And so we have to train our officers to understand that they are our public relations face. And when they go on a call, it can be a routine call, something that we do all the time, we don't even think about. I'll give you an example. Let's say a smoking fuse box in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
We go out. It's dispatched as a structure fire, usually, in most jurisdictions. So we arrive in the street with more value in public property and fire trucks and equipment than the house that we're responding to is worth. We come in. It's a smoking fuse box. We pull the main switch, or maybe pull the meter, depending upon local practices and procedures. We open it up, make sure there's no extension into the wall. We explain to the person that they can contact fire administration on the next business day to get a copy of the report for their insurance company. We explained to them they're going to have to call an electrician to have their box rewired before the power can be put back on. And then we leave. What's going to happen in the few seconds after that? Well, the neighbors are going to come over and say, "Hey, Charlie, what was the fire department doing at your house?" And Charlie's going to tell his story. And then the next day, Charlie's going to go to work and tell his coworkers. And on Saturday, he's going to tell the other parents at the soccer game. And he's going to tell his relatives on the phone. And he's going to tell the people at church what happened at his house. And one five-minute interaction by one of our captains in the field is going to affect the public perception of your fire department among maybe several hundred people or more.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to have that interaction with the fire department, but they're going to hear Charlie's story.
Right, right.
And if Charlie feels like the fire department helped him and gave him good information and saved his house and were respectful of him, his family, his property, that's how the story will get told. If we tracked dirt into his house, if we were surly or short, or we didn't answer his questions, or we left him standing in the dark with no explanation of what to do next, that's what the story's going to be told. And so even our junior officers need to understand the importance they play in things like marketing and public relations.
Without a doubt. It just happened with me yesterday that I had a service provider come into the home, and he saw him right at the front of my house. I have a little wrought iron shelves with fire memorabilia on it. And he asked me, he said, "Are you still a firefighter?" And I said, "No." He says, they're the greatest people in the world. I said, "Well, thanks. What gave you that?" He goes, "Well, a couple of months ago, my mom fell and she fractured her femur and her wrist." I said, "Oh God, that's painful." And we talked about it a little bit because those were the best people. They came in, they calmed her down, they calmed us down. They were taking care of everything. They were soft, they were gentle. He says, "You know what?" He goes, "I just think, firefighters are just the most wonderful people in the world to do this kind of work and do this job, because they never know what they're going to find when they, go through that door, no matter what the phone call says." And I said, "You know what? You're absolutely right. We don't. But it really doesn't matter to us, because we're guided by one thing, and that's, public service." And he kept repeating.
Yeah.
Within the half hour he was in the house doing the work, he just kept saying, "I just can't thank those people enough, and thank you for your service and firefighters all over for what they do." And that one incident, he had no contact with the fire service before that. But that one incident 2 months ago has made all the difference in this young man's, opinion of fire and EMS right then and there.
Yeah, and that one person, at some point in the future, there may be a bond issue to be voted on to build a training center for the fire department, mm-hmm. or to upgrade their communications equipment or what. Which way will he vote?
Exactly. Exactly. So what we do and what we say can have a ripple effect. And the better we do what we do, and the better we say what we say, the larger and the more positive that ripple effect will be.
Right. And, we've trained that captain and his crew very well on how to handle that smoking fuse box.
Mm-hmm.
They know to cut the power. They know to check for extension. They know to fill out the report completely. We've trained him very well to deal with that. When did we train him to interact with the citizen?
Right. Great point. Okay, we're going to take a break here, and when we come back with Chief Jones, we're going to discuss what kind of leaders will fire and emergency services need in the future. And let's remember, the future doesn't mean it's a long distance away. Most of us around today in the fire service still remember September 11th, 2001. And look how our service has changed and evolved since that time. So we're going to have to know, what are we looking for in our leaders in just a decade or decade and a half from now? So we'll discuss that when we come back right after these words. We'll be right back. The tone sound and the dispatcher announces, station 14 and 16, working residential structure. And that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA, strapped on. You're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the Red Cross leg, and head for the open front door where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. Crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? What? Stop everything. What the hell are you thinking? You see it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores in your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down, that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go home to. Face peace on.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few, I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to our third segment on this episode of 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. And our guest today is Chief Daniel Jones, former chief with Chapel Hill Fire Department in beautiful North Carolina. And we have been talking about leadership, and not just the same back and forth about leadership that we see on public social media quite a bit, but what kind of a job is the fire service itself doing in creating and growing, so to speak, leaders? And we have some insufficiencies in it, and we've talked about what we have not been doing, and we've talked about now in the second segment of things we can do and suggestions to help. And now in this third segment, we need to address, well, now that we've covered today, what do we look for tomorrow? What kind of leaders are we going to be looking for the fire service in the future? Chief, if you please.
Well, Steve, I think in talking to various fire service leaders and folks that are fire chiefs now or deputy chiefs, and some of the folks who are national fire service leaders, it's clear that we're at a crossroads in the fire service. We've had a lot of things put on us over the last 10 to 20 years. EMS has become maybe the major driving factor for the fire service. Hazardous materials really came into the fire service in the mid-80s, a responsibility there. Then we saw the development of the urban search and rescue contingent and the really specialized rescue components that are necessary for everything from hurricanes to earthquakes to terrorist attacks. We've had the whole terrorism issue with. You know, when I got into the fire service in the 70s, if you'd have told me we'd be putting ballistics vests on firefighters and being taught about dirty bombs and that sort of thing, I would have thought you were reading science fiction magazines.
Sure.
But that's a reality today.
Absolutely. And sadly.
We're a multi-hazard agency that is dependent upon not just by our communities, but by our regions, our states, and the federal government. you know, there's a lot of talk about emergency management and FEMA and all of that, but if you go to a disaster, you work a disaster, FEMA doesn't have hundreds of thousands of response personnel. State emergency management doesn't have tens of thousands of emergency response personnel. Who the personnel that make up those responses are primarily fire service.
Right.
They come from big departments and little departments, volunteer and career departments, municipal departments and rural departments, metropolitan sized cities and rural one station volunteer fire departments. And they're formed into response teams and task forces and special groups. And that's who the real manpower is for virtually all the natural disasters and some man-made disasters there are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that level of sophistication that we are in now with the technologies we have available to us, the methodologies that are changing for our responses, that's going to require a very sophisticated level of leadership, greater than we've ever seen in the fire service. And we're at this crossroads where the fire service can either become the potential we've always had to be the go-to agency virtually for everything, and or not. Or it will get parsed out. It will get parsed out to law enforcement or to the military or to other nonprofits. So we're really at this crossroads, and the need for leadership that can navigate politics, that can be successful in budget processes, that can deal with public relations and the news media, that can handle internal crises that we see. Breaks my heart when I see fire departments torn apart by ethics violations mm-hmm. or sexual harassment violations or racial problems. We need leadership that can be sophisticated enough to oversee all of this, to deal with the issues quickly and professionally, and to seize the opportunities that are before us and apply those to the best interest of their communities and their regions. We need more regionalization in the fire service. We need agencies, and I'm not talking about combining 20 fire departments into mega fire departments. I'm talking about fire chiefs sitting down at a table together
right.
and working out joint operations and working out mutual aid agreements. We still got areas of the country that don't have mutual aid agreements. This is 2017.
That's hard to believe.
I talk to agencies and say, well, we don't work with them. It's hard to fathom.
It is. It is.
So we need leaders that can look beyond all of that. We need leaders who can see where we're headed in the future, who can work with state and federal governments, who can convince their local leaders of the importance of having their fire department be part of regional and state efforts. We need to recruit really smart people. We need to identify people who have leadership potential and give them that necessary training so that 5 years, 10 years from now, when they're wearing 3, 4, and 5 bugles, they have the skill set necessary to manage this very complex and very advanced and very high demand business that we're in. And we're not doing that right now. We're not preparing people for that. And I see that as a crisis in the fire service.
Well, it is. And as we've just said, that the, one of the things that the fire service demands is change and evolution. One of the things that the fire service dislikes most is change and evolution. So, but the point is that, and I, we mentioned off the air, the Wing Spread 6 conference, which a lot of people may not know, but this conference, which is made up of people from all areas of public safety, from fire, EMS, police, federal agencies, only meets once a decade. And in that meeting, which is several days in, I believe, upstate New York someplace. I don't remember exactly where it is. Oh, in Wisconsin.
I think it's in Wisconsin.
Right. Because it's sponsored by the Johnson Company. And
yes.
When I learned about it this last summer, what it does, imagine you have to sit down and plan a budget for the year for your department. Okay, well, you take a few weeks or a month or so and you put it together. Now, imagine you're sitting at the Wingspread 6-7 conference and you're going to have to plan for a decade. How do you plan for a decade of what to expect? Well, we have been forced in the prior decade to where we are now. We were forced to decide where we were going by what happened on 9/11. That told us what we had to do to prepare for the next decade. And Chief, as you've just said, there are so many type of new and different and unique threats that we face today. We can't even imagine what we may face tomorrow. But if we don't start looking with a broader scope to look at the entire panoramic scene ahead of us of what it's going to take to deal as a fire service or public safety service to our communities in the future, then we are doomed to failure. That we may be unprepared to properly deal with an emergency of a magnitude that, you know, we just can't even fathom today. Just to take one simple one that is an impact from an asteroid or meteor. Okay. Oh, yes. That's never going to happen. I don't think so. Just check with, go online. We have the Near Earth Orbit Department of the government, and they track, not only they track meteors and asteroids, but they're tracking space junk. Several thousands pieces of space junk that falls in every day. Are we prepared to handle a meteor impact in our community that hits a major building at about 17,000 miles an hour, the size of a Volkswagen Beetle? I don't think so, because I don't think any of us have ever thought about it. But that's something that you have to open your eyes to if we're going to prepare for the future.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned the Wingspread 6 conference, because if your listeners can go online and look at that report.
Right.
Look at number 7, their recommendation number 7. It's all about developing our leaders to lead into the future, both current and in future. It talks extensively about the skill sets that are needed. And it's not the skill sets they're talking about in there. They're not talking about leading on the fire ground. They're talking about leading in the community, leading in the region. They're talking about human relations skills. It's important enough that Wingspread conference identified that as one of their top recommendations and priorities.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because they have to imagine what we can't imagine. We don't think of. We're just too busy with our day-to-day lives to think of, we're worried maybe to get to tomorrow, let alone 10 years down the road and what's going to happen. But successfully, we have successfully evolved since 2001. We've improved, but there's always room for improvement. And there's always room to learn more. And I think another important point is that if you're listening to this and you feel that, you know what, you may only be a frontline person right now, but you feel, you've taken some outside stuff and you feel like you'd like to work your way up in the department. You just don't want to be a nozzle jockey your career. You want to, say something to one of your officers or your chiefs. Just do it in private. And, it's not boasting if you tell them, that you're sincere and you'd like to, be part of the public safety in the future. This is what you want to do. And I'm sure most of those officers that would hear that from a frontline firefighter would be absolutely thrilled to hear that kind of dedication to the task.
And officers, current chief officers today, have an obligation to mentor those folks that come
yes.
forward and offer to step up and pursue the necessary education or ask for help in developing their skills. We have an obligation to mentor those folks and to help them so that when they assume the lead of the fire service, as the rest of us step down, they can take it to the next level. You know, that's the ultimate compliment for a chief officer. If when you turn your responsibilities over to somebody else, they can take it further than you took it.
Right.
That's the ultimate compliment to you, because that means you've done a good job of preparing people to assume your role and take it to the next level, and that's what we really need.
Exactly.
Mentorship is so important. And a lot of my success in my career came directly from a variety of mentors that took the time with me during my career to aim me or to give me course corrections or to give me a swift boot in the tail when I was doing the right things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't plan on being a firefighter. I kind of fell into it, as I told you when we spoke last week. And yet I had several mentors in that department. One was, he was one of the caretakers, and we're still good friends to today. The duty captain, and the chief, who, as I mentioned, I was lucky enough to be able to see again after so many years this past summer. And he did mentor me, and I was so surprised when he selected me being there less than a year to go to the State Fire College that North Carolina used to have. And I said,
yeah.
What about all these other, you know, guys who've been here longer than me? He says, I chose you. I see it in you. I want you to go. And he chose the guy who's still my best friend today and one of my business partners. And the third person was the caretaker of one of the 24-hour shifts, who mentored the two of us, me and the other guy, my friend. So between
yeah.
him and the captain and the chief, that's the only reason why I got to where I did in just under 4 years in that fire department, because I had great teachers who were willing to take the time. And teach stuff. And if I'd go down there on a Saturday just to wash the car in the wash pit, the captain would come over. The chief would often come. If he came down in his truck, he was off duty. But he said, let me show you this, Stephen. And he'd take me aside and show me something on the truck. And I want you to know how to use this if we got a call for this, something like that, because I know I can depend on you. And so we spent an
yeah.
hour. And, you know, I'd go home and tell my wife. And she said, wasn't that nice? And I said, yeah. And now, in my later years, as I think back, it wasn't just nice. He was doing what you and I are talking about. He was mentoring me and my friend, mentoring us and getting us trained to the level to be fire service leaders. And
yeah, and a lot of times that mentorship comes, it doesn't have to come from somebody above you. It can come from a peer.
Exactly.
I'll share a quick story with you, Steve. One of my early mentors was a driver operator in Pinellas named Ed Bigger. And Ed was a longtime firefighter, was one of those guys that never wanted to be an officer. He was a driver operator and damn good at it. And he was a mentor. He took us young firefighters under his wing and spent time talking with us and telling us how to get along in the fire service and how to survive and helping us learn new skills and so forth. He spent a lot of time with me as a young firefighter. Years later, when I was promoted to lieutenant, he was one of the first drivers that drove for me. And on one of the first working structure fires that I went to as a lieutenant, we're headed down the street and to a report of a fire on the roof of a grocery store. And when we got far enough down the main street, we could actually see past the tree line. We could see the fire on the roof of the grocery store, even though we were still several blocks away. And I reached over, of course, in those days, we didn't have headsets or all of that that we have today. You had a single radio mic in the cab, and it was in the center of the dashboard. I reached over to get that radio mic to start to give a size up, and I felt Ed's hand. He was driving, but I felt his hand grab my wrist. And he looked over at me, and he said, "You better think about what you're going to say, Junior, before you push that button." And, you know, Steve, I never forgot that little piece of advice, that little kernel of wisdom.
Right.
And even decades later, when I was a fire chief at a scene and I would start to press the radio mic, I would hear driver engineer Bigger's voice in the back of my head saying, "You better think about what you're going to say before you press that button, Junior."
What a great lesson.
Those kinds of mentoring pieces that, when combined with your schooling, your education, your training, your experience, make all the difference in the world.
No doubt about it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you've given us a lot to think about, Chief. You've told it like it is, and we both agree on that. But we see that there are ways that we can improve the situation. And what we hope is that those who are listening to us today are going to take some of what we said to heart, especially what you've said, and they're going to take the ball and run with it to a level, to the best level they feel they're capable of. And
well, let's hope so. My advice to chief officers out there is identify the next generation of leaders in your department and get them the necessary training, so that they don't learn to swim by jumping in the deep end of the pool like you did. And my advice to young officers who aspire to swim in the deep end of the pool is go get the necessary lessons ahead of time. Don't wait until you're up for promotion to assistant or deputy chief. Go get that training. Get yourself prepared ahead of time so that when you do pin on those bugles, you're effective from day one.
That's great. Great advice from a great chief with great experience. And again, his company is called Chief Dan Leadership, LLC. Chief, how do they reach you? Do you have a website, please?
They can reach us through number one, smartcareer.com. Kelly Walsh, my teaching partner, who was the internal HR person in the Mesa Fire Department with Chief Dennis Compton for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
She and I worked together to deliver training, the exact kind of training that we've been talking about for the last hour. And so if you go to onesmartcareer.com and contact us, we'd be happy to work with you to make suggestions for your training program or to even deliver training to you. We've got a variety of options for that. And we can do some classes in your fire department. We can do some online classes. And we even offer some direct one-on-one mentoring services for chief officers. So feel free to contact us. I'm also up on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. Be happy to have you join me there. We share a lot of leadership information through those channels.
That's great. Well, again, Chief, I want to thank you very much for taking time from the schedule. I know you're a busy fellow, as we talked about last week, and appreciate not just the time that you've given us today, but the wisdom that you've shared with us today. And hopefully our listeners will, again, like I said before, take that, and those who have that inner drive will take it and run with it and help make tomorrow's fire service even greater than it is today. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you. And I want to compliment you and your partners on the Five Alarm Task Force. You guys are doing a great job of getting information out to the fire service on a variety of topics. And I would encourage your listeners to invite other members of the fire service to tune in and use these learning experiences that you're providing.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate that. All right, folks, we'll be right back right after these words. Cancer. Ugh. Nobody likes to hear that word. However, as firefighters, that word sure likes us. Here are a couple of facts. One, did you know that among average adults in the U.S., the cancer rate is approximately 20% in a given year? The rate for us? Over 60%. Number two, when you don't wear your full PPE, especially during overhaul, due to the heat and sweat, your uncovered skin pores are wide open, and all those carcinogens in the soot and smoke love to dive right in. Number three, not only is the rate of cancer higher in firefighters, but we get all types of weird forms of cancer. Number four, when you don't clean or change your PPE and your uniform and you don't decon or grab a strong shower afterward, you're dragging all that cancer crap with you everywhere you go. The bays, the day room, your vehicle, even your home. Listen, our job is tough enough, and we have enough to worry about. Don't let cancer get in your way. Talk to your officers and your chief, your fire surgeon, or your personal physician. Learn what you can do to reduce your chances of dealing with a firefighter-relating cancer. Beat cancer before it beats you. The NFPA's data for 2016 and firefighter line-of-duty deaths and injuries has recently come out. And the numbers are interesting, to say the least. There were over 62,000 injuries accorded to firefighters in 2016. And although that number seems very high, it's almost a 9% decrease from the year before, 2015. Of those injuries, over 19,000 resulted in lost time for the firefighters injured. And in 2016, we lost 89 brothers and sisters. That last year, 56 were volunteers, 23 were career, and 10 were wildland firefighters. And it's important, I think, that we remember that our brothers and sisters who are smoke jumpers and wildland firefighters are just as much a firefighter in every sense of the word that those of us who are in the basic 48, or you want to call it any of the states and the communities in which we live. They work high, they work hard, and their work is tough, as is all of us. And that's one of the reasons why we stress the Firefighter Health Initiative. Of those we lost, 17 were passed while engaging in activities at the scene of a fire. 10 passed while responding to emergency incidents. 19 died as a result of vehicle crashes. 9 firefighters died while they were engaged in training activities. And 40 firefighters died from heart attacks, the most frequent nature of fatal injury. And also, we have to remember that currently, cancer, which we know is the vicious enemy that we're currently fighting with our Firefighters Cancer Initiative, is currently not recognized nationally as the source of a line of duty death. So while the numbers are lower, one is too many that we lose. Injuries can't be helped sometimes. They're just the nature of the job, but that doesn't mean we should not keep our eyes on the ball ahead of us and make sure we do everything we can to prevent ourselves from being injured at the firehouse, on the way to the job, at the job, on the way back, and even driving home. Okay? It's our control that we have to exert most of the time to make sure we don't get hurt. And that's done with thinking. We have to think about what we do instead of just rushing in, shooting from the hip, and doing what the ego or the power inside us tells us to do. Think about it. Know your environment. Know what your job is and know how to do it. We hope you've enjoyed today's show. We'll be right back right after these words.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
And that wraps another edition of 5-Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. We'd like to thank our guest, Chief Daniel Jones, who spoke today about what kind of a job does the fire service do to prepare leaders. We hope you enjoyed this topic and learned something from it. Did you know you can now find us and subscribe to us on iTunes? Just search for 5-Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our partners, Dalmation Productions, Inc., the Firehouse Tribune, Fire Tech, Hennessy Distributing, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, and the Great Florida Fire School. Portions of instrumental music on 5-Alarm Task Force are courtesy of Lee Rosevere. Find more of his music at happypuppyrecords.ca. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a comment about a show, please drop us a line to dalmationproductions@outlook.com. We want to know that we are bringing you the topics that you are interested in. You can follow us on Twitter at DalmatProd or at cause_origin. Stay up to date with everything about Dalmation Productions, our podcasts, our blog, all the news about us at our brand new website, www.dalmationproductions.tv. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, and let's make sure everyone goes home.